If you're listening to me right now and are a fan of Insight, you probably love all things true crime and mystery and maybe some conspiracy. I am always searching for what really happened to put my scripts together. And if that's the kind of thing you like, you need to check out the new podcast, Conspiracy Theories. They are going to take these complicated, controversial events and using grounded research and investigators, they're going to shed some light on some possible secrets of these official stories and tell you what they believe is the real truth. Because the truth isn't always the best story, and the official story isn't always the truth. You can check out episodes covering the death of Princess Diana and Area 51 now. New episodes come out every Wednesday, and you can expect episodes on the Illuminati, chemtrails, and much more. Visit Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and search for Conspiracy Theories. Again, that's CONSPIRACYTHEORIES, or visit Parcast.com/conspiracy to start listening now. That's Parcast, PARCAST.com/conspiracy to listen now.
Hello, my name is Ali and this is Insight. Here with me, as she is twice a week now, is Charlie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I've gone back to work for a few months, so things are pretty crazy around here, but we're making it work. Just another reminder that Charlie will be at CrimeCon this year, May 3 to 6 in Nashville. Insight will be on Podcasters Row with some of your favourite podcasts, such as The Vanished, Generation Y, and The Minds of Madness. We do have an exclusive code for 10% off the standard ticket when you use code INSIGHT at checkout at crimecon.com. Today takes us between 2002 and 2005, when a serial killer began operating in the outskirts of Albuquerque, New Mexico. This person or persons became known as the West Mesa Bone Collector and is thought to be responsible for murdering and burying at least 11 women found over 92 acres of land owned by a land developer. All the victims fell between the ages of 15 and 32, and they fit a specific profile. They are suspected to be involved in the Albuquerque drug scene, and they are sex workers. To this day, 9 years after the first victim was discovered, law enforcement have been unable to identify who the killer or killers are. This is despite a long list of suspects, two who are already dead. This week, we are discussing the West Mesa Bone Collector. Albuquerque, New Mexico sits in the middle of the state. It's basically a city built around a river valley above sea level in the high desert. The city has an Indian reservation to the north and to the south. And on the east side of the city is the Sandia Mountains. To the west is a long stretch of open desert and mesa, which is a series of long dormant volcanoes. But to the locals, the directions are associated with the landmarks themselves, in particular the East Mountains and West Mesa. The West Mesa is an eerie place to begin with. It is equal parts inviting as it is ominous. The West Mesa rises up from the valley below, and on the mesa itself you can see all of Albuquerque. The West Mesa is isolated, dusty, and there isn't many people around. In 2001, women started disappearing from the streets of Albuquerque. The Albuquerque Police Department, or the APD, they would later point out that nearly all the women were involved in, quote-unquote, high-risk behaviour, and they were known to have connections to drug use and sex work. The APD would go on to mention this fact at basically every opportunity they could until present day. It was August of 2005 when the APD would release a list of women they knew to be missing or had been reported missing by their family. This list would continue to grow after the release, eventually to 24 women. Some were crossed off this list as time went on. They either turned up back in Albuquerque or somewhere else in the country. But it is clear that something wasn't right. The only common thing the women shared was that they were involved in sex work and many battled drug addiction.
The area a lot of these women worked was known as the war zone. In recent years, this area has gone through redevelopment and is now known as the International District. There is an area on Central Avenue that is somewhat known as a red light district. It's a place where you can find the most vulnerable in society. They are generally looking for money or looking for drugs. It's also a place where people go to prey on those with nowhere else to go. The rumors on the street at the time was that there was an Albuquerque version of Jack the Ripper on the loose, that there was someone preying on victims that society wasn't going to miss. The rumors never went into specifics, saying that the missing girls were dead and were buried in the West Mesa. But this was just seen by law enforcement as a rumor at the time, and there was no evidence to go on. There was no specific place to start. We're talking about a mammoth area here, much too big to randomly start searching for victims based on a rumor alone. Investigators did do what they could. They got dental records and asked for DNA samples from family members of the reported missing women. This work would prove vital later on. As years passed, though, nothing much more came of the investigation. There was very little media coverage because the women were considered less than sympathetic to viewers due to their high-risk lifestyle. The sad thing was that not many people seemed to care. There are varying reports as to how hard or how thorough the police were actually looking. Most of the local media didn't bother mentioning the missing women. The media even turned away family members, refusing to interview them for articles.
On February 2nd of 2009, a woman was taking her dog for a walk near a plot of land on the West Mesa that was slated for construction of a new subdivision. The area had already been cleared of desert flora and heavy machinery had moved in to level out the ground for the project. On a stretch of desert off the 118th Street, almost literally the most southern western corner of the city, this area had been levelled off and staked out by a development company since 2005, but because of an economy problem in the area, there just wasn't enough money to finish the project. But it was on this day that her dog discovered something unusual on their walk. It was common for animal bones to be seen lying around the area, but something about this bone seemed different. The woman took a photo of the bone and sent it to her sister, who worked as a registered nurse. Her sister confirmed her worst thoughts, that the bone looked like a human femur. The woman contacted the APD immediately. They arrived on the scene and confirmed that this was definitely a human bone, and they indeed did have a crime scene on their hands. A crime scene that would eventually become the largest in Albuquerque history. Human bones were found scattered in one section of the development owned by KB Home, and it was the work that had already been completed in the area that made this excavation of the area all that more difficult. The builders had already begun extensive digging and levelling, and a lot of heavy machinery had already been through the site to get it ready for the building of the large community. The problem was that this machinery had shattered a lot of the bones in the process, and most definitely moved them from where they were originally buried.
The investigators brought in state-of-the-art equipment to help process this big crime scene. They used ground-penetrating radar, lasers, aerial photography, they used digital mapping. By the end of the investigation, they had dug through 40,000 cubic yards of dirt and as far as 15 feet deep in some places. It took more than 2 months of searching and digging through the scene before they were satisfied that they had recovered all of the victims that were in that area. In total, there were 11 female victims. They were aged between 15 and 32 years old. One of the victims was 15 weeks pregnant at the time she was murdered. So that would bring the total number of victims unofficially to 12. Recovering the skeletal remains was a long and a difficult process that had to have been frustrating. It would have been like putting together a giant jigsaw puzzle. But not only a jigsaw puzzle, but one where a lot of the pieces were broken into other pieces. It would take 1 year before all 11 victims were officially identified. Thankfully, a lot of the groundwork was done early on with those dental records and that DNA that they already had on file. Even though it still took a year without that on file, who knows how long this could have taken. It would have been significantly longer. Because of this early work, they were able to identify all 11 of these victims, all of whom appeared on that missing persons list that had been compiled years before. Some of the victims we will talk about today have more information than others. We will talk about the victims in the order they went missing, not the date they were found, because that's not the same. But for this episode, and Allie and I like a clear timeline, we're going to talk about the victims from when each went missing.
The first missing woman the APD would name was 20-year-old Darlene Tuggio. Darlene was last seen July 4, 2001, with a drug dealer named George and was never seen again. She told her family beforehand that she was heading to Arizona for a few days, but they never heard from her. Darlene's family think that she was taken to Mexico. George could never be questioned in regards to Darlene's disappearance because he later turned up murdered. Now, it's unlikely that Darlene had anything to do with the West Mesa bone collector, as it would later unfold. But her case was on the original list of the missing women of Albuquerque, so that's why we are mentioning her today. She isn't on the official list of suspected West Mesa victims, though. There have been reports that I've found that Darlene may be still alive and living in Mexico. Today, Darlene would be 35 years old. The first on the official list of West Mesa victims is 21-year-old Monica Candelera. Her mother, Isabel, later reported that Monica was a friendly and happy woman who would do anything for her son. Monica was last seen near an intersection in southwest Albuquerque on May 11, 2003. She was reported missing soon after her disappearance. The APD said that she lived a high-risk lifestyle and may have gang ties. According to court documents, Monica has one conviction for sex work. During the investigation into Monica's disappearance, Isabel reported to police that a man in her neighbourhood by the name of Isaac was overheard saying that Monica had been killed and taken to the West Mesa. Now, investigators did search for her there at the time and did find a human jawbone, but it didn't belong to Monica. Her family did not give up, though. They continued to search the Mesa for a month after this. But the case was eventually turned over to the cold case unit after a couple of months.
The next woman to go missing was 27-year-old Doreen Marquez. Doreen went to West Mesa High School where she was a cheerleader. She later had two daughters that she loved more than anything. She would throw them these extravagant birthday parties, and she just really loved that role. But things took a turn, and Doreen's boyfriend went to jail, and she started using heroin. To pay for her addiction, it's believed she turned to sex work, though she did not have any arrests on her record for it. Because of her addiction, she started spending less time with her daughters, leaving them with her mother or other family members. She would disappear for months at a time. She had recently been kicked out of her sister's home where she was living at the time of her disappearance when the sister found needles in Doreen's possessions. There are two stories of when Doreen was last seen. It was either while dropping one of her children off at school in October of 2003 or in the Borales neighborhood in southwest Albuquerque. We are just looking at, 2 miles, 1.5 kilometers apart. So it doesn't really make much of a difference. Interestingly, though, Borales is only 2.5 miles or 4 kilometers from where Monica was last seen. This is also further conflicted because a friend would be adamant in saying that she had seen Doreen much later than October 2003. So whichever it is, she was reported missing in 2004. And then we have 26-year-old Victoria Chavez. She was last seen in Southwest Albuquerque area in early 2004. However, we don't know for sure when she officially went missing because no one reported anything. She wasn't reported missing until her mother contacted police in March of 2005 because she was worried she hadn't heard from her daughter in about a year. This is something we hear in a lot of these cases. These were women who were always in contact with their families, but would occasionally go months without contact. So it's hard to pinpoint exactly when they went missing. She had 5 convictions for solicitation, and during the time she was missing and not reported, she was on probation, which you would have to assume meant a probation worker to check in with. If she missed any appointments, they were supposed to have been reported, but as far as I can tell, they weren't. Her remains were the first to be identified. Unfortunately, during our research, we couldn't find a whole lot about Victoria as a person. We found that she has a mother who reported her missing, a stepfather who was devastated when she was identified, and she has 2 daughters.
The fourth woman to go missing was 27-year-old Veronica Romero. And again, Veronica is another victim with very little information about her. We know that Veronica was also a mother to 5 children and that she had several arrests for sex work, domestic violence, shoplifting, and criminal trespassing. Veronica was also struggling to control a heroin addiction. Veronica was last seen Valentine's Day, February 14 of 2004, getting into a pickup truck in the central Wyoming area. She was reported missing soon after by her friends because her friends adored and loved her. They blanketed the city in missing persons posters, desperate to find her. I assume there would have been growing concern by people in the sex industry for their safety and the safety of their friends when you think 4 or 5 people have gone missing in a short period of time. The next 2 victims went missing at the same time and they were cousins. Evelyn Salazar was 27. Other reports do say that she was 23 or 24 years old. And her 15-year-old cousin, Jamie Bolera, and they were last seen together on April 3rd of 2004. They were leaving a family gathering at Jamie's house, telling everyone they were going to a park near the intersection of San Mateo and Gibson. Jamie hadn't planned on being gone very long. Her mother later reported that she left her curling iron on in the bathroom. Her mother would also report Jamie to be happy and outgoing, who loved to entertain others by singing and dancing. Evelyn had a daughter who she adored. She would make even the most complex recipes look easy. They were both reported missing within a week of last being seen. Initially, both Jamie and Evelyn were treated as runaways by police. Their family members would later be quoted as saying in news articles that the police did very little in ways of an investigation to find the 2 women. In fact, after the missing persons report was filed, they barely even heard from the police again.
The next victim was 15-year-old Solania Edwards. Solania wasn't on the original list of missing women that was released in 2005. The reason for this was that Solania was reported to be missing from Lawton, Oklahoma, where she had run away from a group home she was living in. Local police had her classified as being an endangered runaway. Solania was different from the other victims in that she didn't have family or friends in Albuquerque. She never knew her father, and her mother had placed her in foster care when she was only 5 years old. She was also the only African-American victim. It's believed that she was a circuit girl traveling with a group of women, probably all of them around the same age. Circuit girl means that she was traveling to events where there were crowds. In this case, her group was traveling along the I-40 highway, working as a sex worker. though at 15 and an endangered runaway, I'm going to go ahead and call her trafficked. That's how she ended up in Albuquerque. Early in the investigation, a witness contacted the police claiming they saw Celiana in Denver in the spring and summer of 2004. The eighth woman to go missing was 22-year-old Virginia Cloven. Virginia grew up in a small trailer, and she was funny. She was popular when she was a teenager. She was the kind of person who, if she told a lie, she couldn't commit to it. She'd have to come and tell the truth afterwards because she felt so bad about it. But when she was 17, still in high school, her brother was shot and killed in a homicide. It would later be ruled to be in self-defense. Virginia struggled heavily with this loss. She ran away from home a week later. She then lived with her grandfather for a time in Albuquerque before she eventually moved in with a boyfriend who was known as Puppet. But things didn't get any easier. By this stage, Virginia and Puppet were struggling with drug addiction, and she had turned to sex work to support them and to support their habit. Virginia's parents would bring them groceries to make sure they ate. Not long after that, Puppet got hit by a car, went into a coma, and eventually died. Virginia couldn't afford to keep the home on her own, and she ended up homeless. A year later, she called her father asking him if she could see him for his birthday. He told her that she needed to clear up her citations, and they made plans to see each other in Albuquerque, but she never showed. The last her parents heard from her was in June 2004. That's when they talked to her, and she said she had a new boyfriend, a man known as Robert. And she told them that Robert had just gotten out of prison and she was probably going to marry him. But by the time October rolled around and they hadn't heard back from her, they reported her missing.
Cinnamon Elks was 32 years old. She was friends with three of the other victims, Veronica, Julie Nito, and Michelle Valdez. And we'll talk about both of them in a moment. When Cinnamon's mother, Diana, didn't hear from her for her birthday in August of 2004, she knew something was wrong. She would report her missing right away, but it would take 5 phone calls to police for them to actually take down her details and list her as officially missing. Diana was initially told that Cinnamon was an adult and could disappear on her own accord and would most likely return. And this was because of Cinnamon's past. She was known to frequently run off and for long stretches of time, and then she would return with the intent of cleaning up her life. But during the times that she was gone, she would always remember to call her mother for her birthday. So when the call didn't come in 2004, Diana knew there was something wrong. Diana would later report that Cinnamon was the perfect child. She was well-mannered, well-behaved, and loved school. But when Cinnamon entered her teenage years, things began to change. Cinnamon became addicted to alcohol and drugs, which led to numerous convictions for forgery. To support her drug habit, Cinnamon stole checks and forged her mother's name on them. Eventually, she turned to sex work to earn the money she needed for drugs. All of this, her addiction and criminal record, led to Cinnamon losing custody of her two children. Julie Nito was 23 years old. She was always on the small size, so because of that, she developed a love of sewing, something that she'd always do with her mother. She was also a caring mother to her young son, who she doted on. She worked with underprivileged teens to help them find jobs when they left school. But life got too much. The pressures of raising a child and being very young still herself, being a single parent. When Julie was 19 years old, she turned to drugs to help her cope. Her mother, Eleanor, tried to help her daughter and paid for treatment on several occasions, but it didn't work. The last time Julie's family saw her was on the day her grandfather had an outpatient procedure done in August of 2004. The family got together at his house to calm the man's nerves. Sometime after that, Julie's son had a surgery scheduled and she didn't show. It was then that Eleanor knew there was something very wrong. Eleanor was adamant that there was no way Julie would miss being there for her son when he had surgery. Julie was reported missing soon after by her mother.
Michelle Valdez was 22 years old. She was a devoted mother to her daughter. Michelle was known as a kind and good-hearted person who would just do anything for other people. Unfortunately, due to life circumstances or maybe just crossing paths with the wrong people, something we see with so many of the victims, Michelle turned to drugs and started to disappear for days at a time. Days would turn into weeks, weeks into months. Something that she would always do, though, she would always visit her father. Dan Valdez would tell his daughter that he was worried about her and asked her to come visit more often so he would know she was okay. When she did visit him, he would always give her a small amount of money. He knew she was going to use it to buy drugs. But in his mind, he knew that by giving her the money, it would mean she would always come back for more and he would see her and be able to check in with her. One day in February of 2005, she never came back. She was reported missing soon after. It would later be confirmed that Michelle was 4 months pregnant at the time of her death. In less than 20 days, the remains of the 11 women and one fetus were discovered. It would had to have been a frightening prospect because with that time frame, almost every day there was a news report of the discovery of another set of remains unearthed. The APD's list of missing women from 2001 had 24 people listed at the time the first bone was discovered.
The APD determined that the majority of the women had been murdered and buried on the West Mesa during 2003 and 2004, and that was based on the decomposition and the dates of the disappearances of the victims. Initial construction and development of the land had started between July of 2004 and June of 2005, and this was confirmed by satellite records. Police were able to put a timeline together using these records. Satellite records taken in 2002 showed nothing unusual. However, satellite records taken 2 years later showed something else entirely. They showed tire marks leading to bare spots that matched up with the locations where the victims' remains were found. Satellite records taken in 2005 showed these tire tracks again and even more bare spots. The satellite records showed an evolving snapshot of their killer's work. And we know it was around this time that the construction work on the area changed this landscape for good. And the last woman that was missing that was discovered at the site was last seen by her family in September of 2004. It is clear by this that if any of the women on the APD's list went missing after Michelle Valdez and they were victims of the same killer, chances are he would have had to change his disposal method or location due to construction crews expanding the city. Any return visit would have been too big of a risk on the killer's part.
10 of the 11 victims were known sex workers. As we mentioned earlier, Jamie Borrella was the sole exception to this. Jamie went missing with her cousin, Evelyn Salazar, and Evelyn did have one prior conviction for sex work, so that common thread is still consistent here in the disappearances. A huge task force was put together with over 40 police assembled to investigate the murders, and we don't even know how many people were working with them. The task force was given the name of the 118th Street Task Force, named after where the victims were found. Investigators knew they had to gather information as quickly as possible because as many as 8 years elapsed since the first murder. These cases were cold by the time they found out they happened. Every body discovered was decomposed, so there was little to no tissue to offer vital evidence. The Office of Medical Examiner would not even conclusively be able to give a cause of death. I've read some speculation that the cause of death was determined to be strangulation, but I couldn't find any concrete sources to back that up. Many of the women were matched with known dental records. Others were matched through a combination of forensic reconstruction and honestly just some luck. What investigators did have, though, were the victims' families. Almost every news source and basically all the police reports would like to remind you that these women were involved in sex work and drugs. But the part that's easily overlooked is that every woman that went missing and was eventually found in West Mesa had family or friends, or in the case of the girl missing from Oklahoma, had social workers that noticed their absence and reported them missing. If it wasn't for these families that loved and cared for these women, the investigators would have had nothing. The transgressions of these women do not outweigh the loss of their lives. And hopefully we were able to highlight some of that loss today when we talked about them and their parents and their kids. I think it's important to remember that no matter how many times someone will remind you that sex work and drugs were a part of their lives, they were loved and they were missed. The APD were reluctant in the early stages to publicly confirm that they were dealing with a serial killer. Their common line, which we hear in other cases, is that it was too early to tell and to really commit to what they were dealing with, and that they had to stay open to all possibilities.
We just need to take a quick break for a word about one of our sponsors this week, Blue Apron.
Blue Apron is the leading meal kit delivery service in the U.S., and there's a good reason why. When I get my Blue Apron box, I know I'm getting fresh, pre-proportioned ingredients, I'm getting these beautiful step-by-step recipe cards, and I can cook these meals in under 45 minutes. The menu changes every week based on what's in season, and it is designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team. We talk a lot about what Blue Apron is, but let me tell you a little bit more about some meals you can get. Blue Apron has meals like strip steaks with potatoes and spicy maple collard greens, which is a steakhouse-inspired favorite, but it has this chili-infused maple syrup that's a twist. It's something you probably haven't had before. That's one of the things I've said before is my favorite thing about Blue Apron is just trying new foods. With the flexibility of Blue Apron, 12 recipes each week, and you can pick 2, 3, or 4 of them based on what fits your schedule best. And if you like things that are spicy, the spicy chicken and stir-fried vegetables with jasmine rice sounds delicious, it looks delicious, and it cooks in under 45 minutes. You'll feel good about making these meals and providing them to your family. Blue Apron is treating Insight listeners to $30 off your first order if you visit blueapron.com/site. So check out this week's menu. Get your $30 off at blueapron.com/site. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
The 118th Street Task Force moved across the city, interviewing anyone who may have had any information at all. Interviewing anyone that may have had any information at all. Families came first, and from these initial interviews, a rough timeline of events was created. The next huge hurdle in the case was obtaining more information from the people that these women associated with. Whether they were friends or even known associates, information was hard to come by because these investigators were trying to interview people that didn't want to be interviewed. But their primary mission was to find and interview people with quote-unquote similar lifestyle to these women. In just a few years, police had conducted well over 200 interviews. Every scrap of information, every rumour had weight and importance to the investigation, and from that, theories started to form. Profiles were created. One theory that gained momentum was that the killer frequented the area at the time of the annual state fair, as fair time sees a major increase in both sex work and gang violence. This would lead to an unlikely suspect because the problem with this theory is the state fair is always in late August or early September, and almost no disappearance lines up with this timeline. Investigators also looked into the gang activity angle. Some of the victims were reported or suspected to have gang connections, meaning it was possible they could have been executed by gang members after running drugs for them. Another popular theory at the time was that a local pimp was responsible. And yet another theory was it was someone who had a hatred for sex workers and thought they were doing the Lord's work by killing them.
part of putting together a list of possible suspects, police looked for men that lived in the area who had a history of violence towards women, particularly violence towards sex workers. Unfortunately, that list was not short. Several were eliminated based on their timeline, but the list was still extensive. FBI profilers were called in to assist. They believed the offender to be a male, ages 35 to 50. He either lived alone or was traveling away from home for extensive periods of time. He probably had previous run-ins with the law for minor offenses. He would have been someone who liked to hire sex workers or was at least familiar with that world. Now, obviously, this profile is pretty generic and it could fit a number of people. Just like any other case where profile is given, police could not 100% rule out someone just because they didn't fit the profile. It's not that exact of a science. The FBI and APD offered a $100,000 reward for any information that would lead to the arrest and conviction of the person responsible or persons responsible for the West Mesa murders. This reward remains current to this day. But as happens when large rewards are announced, the police were inundated with prank calls and false confessions, and even people who were trying to help but were giving bad information and were just misguided in these efforts. Not long after the investigation started, the APD had a list of 10 plausible suspects, at least 10. Things were starting to come together, and 4 months after all the bodies were found, APD had announced that they had narrowed the list to 5 main suspects.
Fred Reynolds was a known pimp. He had been arrested for this in 1998 and 2001, and he had ties to several of the victims. But something that caught the investigators' attention was that he had photographs of 3 of the victims of the West Mesa. The problem with reading too much into this, though, Reynolds was known to run an illegal escort service, and because of this, he may have had these photographs because the woman worked for him at one time or another. They seized computers, records, anything he had, and allegedly one of the photos of the known victims had the word missing written on it. Why? We don't know. Reynolds never clarified that. But it is an interesting part of the story, and it doesn't quite add up to me. Before the remains at West Mesa was discovered, 2 women were in contact with Reynolds. One of these was Lori Galeos, who was the sister of Doreen Marquez, and the other was Amy Reed, who was the sister of one of the original missing who was not located among the victims at the West Mesa. But both of these women were reported as saying that Reynolds was a good man and that he just wanted to help women, especially those with drug addictions. Neither woman thought it was strange that Reynolds had the photos. Both reported that Reynolds had these photos to use when he would ask people about the whereabouts of these women when he was concerned because he hadn't seen them for a while. This may explain the word missing written on the photo, but I don't know. There would be one more issue with the investigation into whether Fred Reynolds was responsible. On January 2nd of 2009, 1 month before the first bone was discovered, Reynolds died of natural causes at age 60.
Scott Lee Kimball was originally from Boulder, Colorado, and a tick in the Kimball is the West Mesa bone collector column is that Kimball is already a convicted serial killer. During a stretch of time between 2003 and 2005, Kimball murdered at least 4 people for a bunch of reasons that aren't reasons to kill anybody. He disposed of their bodies in remote locations in Colorado and Utah. To this day, only 3 of the bodies have been recovered. We don't generally cover serial killers, but I know Allie said that Kimball is an interesting one that she would want to cover at some stage, so we're not going to get into too much detail today, but let's point out some things that are important to the West Mesa case. Kimball was working as an FBI informant during the times the murders occurred. Not only that, but Kimball was very boastful, claiming that he had killed dozens more people than what's currently assumed. His travels at the time do have him in New Mexico broadly at the time of the murders, so the timeline somewhat fits. But he was also allegedly responsible for other murders in Colorado during this time period. He was working elsewhere. He was even in prison. He was in court. So it's not entirely a perfect fit. The FBI do believe that he is responsible for more murders in Colorado. And it seems to be that's where he committed his murders. I assume they believe that for good reason. He could have traveled between the states committing murders in multiple places, but I'm not swayed. What I think mostly sways me against Kimball, though, as the West Mesa Bone Collector, in 2010, Kimball sent correspondence to a cousin of his in which he said that he found out he was being investigated as part of this investigation. Now, remembering that Kimball is pretty happy to boast about the dozens of people he has killed, he put in this letter that he did not do it. He denied all involvement. Now, serial killers lie. We're not naive. But he was the type that enjoyed the notoriety of being a serial killer and was probably bragging about things he didn't do. So I think if he was responsible, he would have absolutely taken credit for it. I mean, he would have at least alluded and teased a little that he could be. Scott Lee Kimball is currently serving a 70-year sentence in a Colorado prison.
The next suspect was Ron Irwin. On August 3rd of 2010, federal and local investigators searched the home and businesses of Irwin. They removed a literal truckload of documents and photographs that he had taken from this raid. The official reason why Irwin came to the police attention is not clear. What we do know, though, is that Irwin travelled to New Mexico starting in the mid-1990s as a photographer, and these trips would add up to being as many as 3 or 4 a year. If we go back to the APD's odd theory of women disappearing during the state fair, this also lines up with Irwin's own admission that he travelled to be in Albuquerque at state fair times in the early 2000s. We also know that Irwin was in New Mexico when Veronica Romero, Jamie Bolera, and Evelyn Salazar went missing. I think adding these points together would be reason alone to be allowed a warrant. Shortly after Irwin's properties were searched, the APD released a series of 6 photographs with 7 women pictured in them. The APD would not comment where these photos came from. They simply stated that they needed help identifying and locating the women in the photos as part of the West Mesa murders. It's important to note that none of these women were known West Mesa victims, but all of these photos were cropped and released to the public. Now, if you search for these photos online, they are disturbing, so discretion is advised. And I could only find reference to 4 of the women being identified as being accounted for and safe. Now, while the APD never stated where they obtained these photos from, Irwin had no problem saying that they were his. At least, he thought so anyway. He said that while he didn't recognise a few of them, he had likely taken them. He also stated that he had nothing to do with the state the women were in the photos, and he was only documenting street life as he found it. Suspicions had also been raised after a tornado destroyed a couple of Irwin's properties and objects were found that made the APD take another look. But nothing more was found than quote-unquote bones. This line of investigation is usually glossed over in contemporary news articles and I couldn't find any information about this. Irwin was never actually questioned during the investigation, and about a year after the warrants were executed, Ron Irwin was officially removed as a suspect by the APD.
Lorenzo Montoya was a 39-year-old man in 2006. He was living in a mobile home in South Valley, which is less than 2 miles or 3 kilometers from the mass burial ground. On December 17th, 3 in the morning, Montoya bound a woman in duct tape, raped her, and strangled her to death. This woman would later be identified as 19-year-old Sharika Hill. Police would refer to Sharika's death as brutal, premeditated, and very violent. Montoya had already had a known history of violence towards sex workers, the APD were already piecing together a theory that connected Montoya to the disappearances of several known sex workers since 2001, and this is 2 years before the remains were even found in West Mesa. They suspected him in as many as 11 disappearances and presumed murders. It's true that the police didn't suspect the specific 11 women they found in West Mesa, but Montoya was on their radar for several missing women since 2001, and for good reason. Google Montoya and you'll find several pieces written about him that go over one, maybe two events in varying degrees of detail. But Montoya was unmistakably an extremely violent individual. One event in particular was to his then-girlfriend, and it is alleged that Montoya repeatedly beat her, threatened to kill her, and bury her in lime. It was also reported that Montoya did unspeakable things to her, but no further details have been made available. In 1998, Montoya was arrested as part of a sting. Montoya picked up a sex worker and was directed to a rundown motel in Albuquerque Central. Montoya offered the woman $40. Unfortunately for him, this woman was actually an undercover police officer.
He was undeterred by all of this. Montoya picked up another sex worker on November 3rd, 1999. What Montoya didn't know is that the APD's vice squad was watching known sex workers in the area. Montoya drove this woman to an area in southwest Albuquerque, which is known as being a maze of dead-end streets and industrial buildings. Montoya parked his truck and forcibly made the woman perform sex acts on him. He threatened her with violence if she didn't comply, and then he began to strangle her. The woman would later report to the police that Montoya seemed to be enjoying himself in the process. Fortunately for this woman, police found the vehicle at this time and arrested Montoya for criminal sexual penetration and kidnapping. What is unfortunate, though, is that the woman would later become uncooperative with police, I'd say likely due to her lifestyle. At the time of Montoya's arrest, it was clear that he was never intending to pay the woman, that's if, in fact, he intended her to live. In his possession was only $2 in cash, but all charges were later dropped. But back to the night or early morning of December 17, 2006. There are a lot of conflicting or confusing details what happened here. But contemporary news articles were referred to 19-year-old Sharika Hill as either being a dancer or a sex worker. And the man she was with, 18-year-old Frederick Williams, he was either her boyfriend or pimp. Neither of which is important to the story or to them as people. But Lorenzo Montoya met Sharika Hill online and arranged for a private performance at his mobile home in the South Valley. Sharika picked up Frederick Williams on the way, and the two of them parked on the road from Montoya's house. Sharika continued by herself on foot while Williams waited down the road in the car. After about an hour, Williams started to worry that Sharika hadn't returned yet and was wondering what was taking so long. So he approaches Montoya's home. Now, this is the last detail that every report, even reports in the same news outlet, would have in common. What happens next is anyone's guess, but we'll lay it all out for you and you can decide for yourself. Initially, it was reported that Williams entered Montoya's home and saw Sharika bound, gagged, and deceased. Williams then pulled out a firearm, fired a single round, and killed Montoya. Another report says that when Williams walked up to Montoya's home, Montoya came outside with a shotgun. Williams shot Montoya because he felt threatened, killing him, and that's when he went inside and found Sharika deceased.
In a later report, it was said that Williams walked up to Montoya's home and found Montoya dragging the deceased and bound Sharika towards his truck. Williams told police that he thought he saw Montoya produce a firearm, so Williams did the same, fearing for his life, shooting and killing Montoya. It turns out, though, Montoya was only holding a flashlight. And finally, the fourth version is the same as the version before, except Montoya was putting a deceased Sharika in his truck and actually did have a gun and fired first, therefore Williams' shot was in self-defense. So what did happen here? Only investigators and the people there know for sure. The only details we know is that by the time the police had arrived in the scene, Montoya was dead by a gunshot wound, and Sharika was strangled and bound by the ankles, knees, and wrists with duct tape and a cord. Police believe the evidence at the scene pointed to planning and premeditation, making it unlikely this was Montoya's first murder. No charges were ever laid on Williams for his part in Montoya's death. The last West Mesa victim to disappear that has been discovered went missing September of 2004. The last in the series of women from this broad time frame to disappear was May of 2006. Lorenzo Montoya, one of the two main suspects in the West Mesa murders, died on December 17th, 2006. 2 years later, when the body started showing up, investigators remembered that Montoya case. A look at those satellite records that we were talking about earlier that were taken in March of 2004 showed vehicle tracks leading directly from Montoya's mobile home to the dump site. This was after the fifth victim, Veronica Romero, was reported missing. By that time, Montoya's mobile home and all of his possessions had been disposed of. It had been 2 years, after all. The problem is the APD know very little about Montoya, but no ties could be found linking him to any of the women found buried at the site, aside from that they were sex workers and he was a known John. They couldn't connect him to any of them specifically. The APD did not feel there was sufficient evidence to declare Montoya responsible for the murders, and they closed the case on him. To me, though, he appears to be the strongest suspect.
And finally, on February 9, 2009, a woman named April Gillen picked up her telephone and contacted the APD. She said that she was the ex-wife of a man named Joseph Blee, and that she thought that the police should look into her ex-husband in connection with the remains found on 118th Street. Joseph Blee was more well-known to the APD than even the likes of Lorenzo Montoya. Blee's criminal history began when the 19-year-old in the late 1970s, Blee was arrested and charged with three counts of domestic burglary when he had stolen women's clothing. Blee was sentenced to 5 years probation and ordered to have a mental diagnostic checkup. Only months after this, Blee was arrested for indecent exposure and ordered to a behavioural health institute where doctors determined that Blee was intelligent but also disturbed and that he required immediate psychological treatment. Now, I think it's unlikely that Blee ever received this treatment because just a couple months later, he was again picked up for a second indecent exposure charge. And because of that probation violation, he spent 2 years in prison. After this, his behaviour only escalated. Blee was charged with third-degree criminal sexual penetration in 1981. This was downgraded to an aggravated assault charge, and he spent another 2.5 years in prison. And then, on the morning of May 29, 1985, 22-year-old sex worker Jennifer Lynn Shrim was found brutally beaten to death and left on the side of the road underneath some bushes. The case was investigated and there was an arrest made. However, in 2006, all charges were dropped against this man because DNA evidence didn't link him to Jennifer. The DNA collected was a match to Joseph Blee. However, no formal charges have been made against Blee in Jennifer's death. Not long after this, though, Blee began stalking women and teen girls. But this soon escalated again. On one occasion, Blee broke into the home of an 8th grade girl. He was wearing a balaclava and armed with a knife. He waited in her home for her to get home from school. He held her at knife point and raped her in the living room. He then ordered the girl to go into the bathroom. He secured the door closed with a telephone cord to prevent her from escaping. She would later be found by her mother when she got home from work.
This wouldn't be an isolated incident. The youngest of his victims would be only 13 years old. A college student would later report that she was also raped at knife point by Blee. According to court records, he was charged with battery on January 9th, 1997, to which he pleaded guilty in exchange for a deferred sentence. On August 31st, 2008, he was charged with aggravated assault and inflicting grievous bodily harm with a deadly weapon. These charges were dismissed. On February 13th, 2009, he was charged with first-degree kidnapping, aggravated battery with a deadly weapon, with a causing grievous bodily harm, and possession of paraphernalia. These charges were also dismissed, and you're going to see a pattern. On August 24th, 2010, Blue was charged with criminal sexual penetration with intent to cause grievous bodily harm, great mental anguish, and kidnapping with the intent of causing grievous bodily harm. And again, these charges were dismissed. In fact, between 1990 and 2000, the APD would come across Blee in person or by name in excess of 100 times. On one occasion, he exposed himself to a sex worker and was picked up by police. They found a roll of electric tape and a length of rope on the passenger seat of his vehicle. April Gellin, his wife, had a number of disturbing details to divulge to police about his connections to the remains found in West Mesa. April would state that her ex-husband was working as a landscaper in the mid-2000s, and he would frequently take late-night trips out to the West Mesa to illegally dump landscaping materials and trash rather than pay that whole $3 or $4 it would have taken for him to dispose them legally at the city dump. The fact that it was landscaping materials will become important in a moment.
In the weeks that follow, the 118th Street Task Force started covertly observing Blee's movements. On more than one occasion, Blee would cruise the Albuquerque Strip, slowly circling blocks and seemingly watching the sex workers. During the interviews that the task force were conducting for their investigation, a sex worker who knew Blee had relayed to them that he wanted to tie her up during one sexual encounter. This made her uncomfortable and she refused. Around October of 2009, police raided Blee's home and confiscated jewellery that did not belong to his current wife or daughter, along with some women's underwear. Cheryl Blee, who was his wife at the time, she would later report that she found a stash of women's jewellery in the house and then found women's underwear in the garden shed. Cheryl would go on to say that Blee wanted to wear women's underwear during sex and she didn't think any more of it. Investigators have not commented on DNA testing on both the jewellery and the underwear. However, the father of the eighth victim, Virginia Colvin, he stated in an interview that several of the victim's families noticed that there were jewellery missing from the victim's belongings, but I haven't found any further elaboration on that. Joseph Blee was convicted of two counts of rape he committed in 1988 and 1990. This whole trial was among the strangest that I've encountered from my research for Insight. Both the defence and the prosecution agreed ahead of time the details of the conviction because both sides knew that a conviction was likely. No witnesses were called and a jury reached a verdict within 15 minutes of being sequestered. The judge handed down 18 years for each charge to be served concurrently, meaning that Blee would be imprisoned for 36 years. And then on July 30 of 2015, Blee suddenly came forward and pleaded no contest for six additional counts, five counts of criminal sexual penetration and one count of kidnapping. While each count would have carried 18 years each, the sentence was capped at 54 years, also to be served consecutively with the previous two convictions. At 58 years old, Blee would be behind bars for 90 years, meaning that he would die in prison.
So what is this connection with the landscaping materials, I hear you ask? We brought it up and then dropped it. During the sifting of ton after ton of dirt, a small piece of plastic was found with the remains of one of the women. The plastic was a specification tag for a tree. This tag was tracked to a wholesaler of landscaping plants in California. From there, it was traced to a local shop where Blee frequented. And Blee's own seized records indicate that he regularly made purchases from the nursery the plant came from. While in custody, he has shown particular interest in the West Mesa case. In one particular conversation he had with a former cellmate, he told him that he knew several of the victims. He called the victims trashy and went on to say that he paid several of the victims for sex acts and had even hit one of them. When Blee was questioned, he and his lawyer have repeatedly denied any involvement with the West Mesa murders. He adamantly maintains his innocence to this day.
There are a couple of similar events that have taken place in the story that are both bizarre and unsettling. And I found them mentioned once or twice in news reports, but there never was enough facts to back up their appearance. I couldn't find anything to substantiate how true they are, and at the end of the day, they could be just pranks. But if they're not, it does add another layer to this story. Before the bodies were discovered, at least two of the families received abrupt phone calls. One family was simply told that the woman was dead and buried, and the other family received a call that told them that their daughter had been stabbed to death. There were no other phone calls that I'm aware of. That was until 2010. A private investigator named George Walker got involved in the case, and he took out ads asking for information relating to the case and the victims. During his time investigating the case, Walker received at least three phone calls from someone either claiming to have information about the case or claiming to be the murderer. There were also reports that there were similar emails sent to Walker. Nothing ever came from the phone calls or the emails, and they stopped as abruptly as they started. So where are we now? Months after the investigation started, the suspect list was reported by the APD as being five people long. By the end of 2015, and going into the seventh anniversary of the discovery of the first body, the suspect list was again extended to be at least 20 people long, and that's where it remains to this day. The 118th Street Task Force has now been downsized to just one person, a Detective Mark Mannery. And Detective Mannery works full-time on the case, which grows colder as the years pass. The APD reported that in 2015, they still receive over 40 calls a year that come into the tip line about the case, and each call is still followed up.
With this case, I think the Albuquerque Police Department was smart to investigate Montoya as far as it went, but when they couldn't really solidly link him, they just moved on to look into other avenues. They very easily could have said it was probably him, because if you ask me, it was probably him, and move on and close the case on this. So I think they're doing right by the victims by making sure that the person who did do this is identified. Of the known suspects, I think Lorenzo Montoya is a very, very likely suspect. And I, you know, of course, we have to hope it's him because he is now deceased and can no longer commit these crimes. But I definitely lean towards it being him.
I'm the same. I think reading about each suspect, it seems Montoya, with what he did to Sharika Hill, it kind of fits in with the profile of what happened to the other victims. The way it stands at this very moment, the person or persons responsible for the murders, and we didn't even mention the likelihood today, but these murders could be the work of more than one person. However, I don't think that's the case. I think the APD and the FBI are fairly confident we're looking at one serial killer here. But the person or persons responsible for the deaths of the 11 women and one baby could be dead, imprisoned, or the person who became known as the West Mesa Bone Collector, he may have another stash of women in shallow graves somewhere else out there.